Wolf was deeply grateful for Pollard's help in getting him the mount. He made Pollard a promise. If Seabiscuit won, he'd split the riding fee with him. 10% of the $100,000 purse. Chapter 12. All I Need is Luck. It was raining again. Through the week before the 1938 Santa Anita handicap, the barn roof hummed with the downpour. Los Angeles flooded. The city and track were completely cut off from all wire service. Smith sat on the damp shed row day and night, hovering around Seabiscuit, and slowly grew ill. Howard found him there, nursing a frightening cough. He urged him to see a doctor. Smith waved him away and stayed at work. As the days passed, the cough grew worse until Howard arrived one day and found Smith barely able to stand. Howard rushed to a telephone to summon an ambulance. But when it arrived, Smith refused to leave his horses. No amount of encouragement from Howard could get him to budge. The ambulance crew left, and Smith went back to work. Gradually, the cough quieted. Everyone was jumpy. Seabiscuit snoozed behind an impenetrable wall of security. A man slept inside his stall at night. Howard hired three guards to stand by the stall, one in the daytime, two at night. The second nighttime guard was under orders to keep the first one talking so neither of them would doze off. Smith had them all in a password system, and anyone who came near was aggressively questioned. A police dog named Silver, trained to pace up and down the shed row, stood patrol. Seabiscuit lived behind an electric stall door that Smith had designed and built himself. Consisting of wire mesh, stretching from floor to ceiling, it was rigged to set off a siren if anyone tampered with it. A brigade of Chicago guerrillas armed with Tommy guns might be able to get to Seabiscuit after shooting down everybody on the lot, said Howard. But one man trying to sponge Seabiscuit would have about as much chance as a kindergarten kid trying to jimmy his way into the United States Mint with a fountain pen. Seabiscuit was safe, but Wolf was not. 2 days before the race, the police informed him that someone was trying to kidnap him. The unidentified perpetrators planned to injure him, drug him, or hold him hostage on the day of the race, preventing him from riding and leaving Howard and Smith little time to find a qualified jockey. Their hope was that without Wolf, Seabiscuit would lose, enabling wagers on long shots to pay off. The frightening thing was that the kidnappers had not been identified. Anyone with whom Wolf came into contact could be after him. Wolf promptly hired two burly bodyguards. For 2 days, they tailed him everywhere. Friday morning, the rains broke. The track was an oval of standing water. The superintendent dragged out the asphalt baking machines and slowly dried the course. The post positions were drawn. Seabiscuit was again unlucky. He drew post 13, well outside in the 19-horse field. On the night before the race, Wolf and his bodyguards joined Smith at Pollard's bedside. The three talked long and late of the race, the most formidable of Seabiscuit's life. Every single top horse in training, save War Admiral, was in the field. Seabiscuit's 130-pound assignment was by far the highest weight. A colt named Stagehand, the early favorite for the 1938 Kentucky Derby, had been assigned just 100 pounds, the lowest possible impost. He had slipped into the race with such a light assignment by virtue of a peculiarity in the race's weight system. To make it easier for the handlers of top horses to plan for the race, Santa Anita officials had assigned the weights 2 months before, on December 15th. On that date, Stagehand's 100-pound impost was justified. He was only 2 years old, had never won or even run particularly well in any race, and he was about to begin 1938 as a claimer. His opening odds were 150-1. But since December, he had turned three and reeled off four sensational victories, including one in the $50,000 Santa Anita Derby, making his 100-grander weight assignment grossly unfair. The impost was so low that trainer Earl Sandy had to send all the way to Miami to get a tiny smudge of a man named Nick Wall, the only top rider in the country who could make the weight. A 30-pound weight concession to Stagehand might be insurmountable, and Wolf knew it. Stagehand was the horse to beat. On the morning of the 1938 Santa Anita Handicap, the Howards drove over to St. Luke's Hospital. Pollard, wan and frail, sat in a wheelchair and waited for them. In what must have been an excruciating effort, he had pulled a neat white dress shirt and tie over his ravaged chest. He had combed his hair, shaved, and slid a dark suit jacket over one arm, leaving the other jacket arm to hang free over his sling. 2 weeks before, as he swung his leg over Phaeronitis's back, he had looked boyish for his 28 years. Now he was suddenly and permanently old. The Howards brought him to their car and saw him inside. Pollard had no business being out of bed at all, but he had talked his doctors into letting him attend the race on the condition that two of them, plus a nurse, go with him. They rolled him into Santa Anita. 70,000 fans swarmed the plant. Marcella accompanied Pollard up through the grandstand. At the top, they stopped. A long catwalk, arching over the crowd, stood between them and the announcer's booth. The chair would not fit on it. Slowly, painfully, Pollard rose from the chair and limped along the catwalk, pursued by his doctors and nurse. Someone in the crowd below looked up and recognized him. He nudged another fan and pointed to the jockey, and suddenly the whole crowd was gazing up at him. Someone yelled his name and began to clap. One clapper became two, then three. Soon the whole grandstand was cheering wildly. Pollard straightened himself up and bowed. Pollard and Marcella arrived at the end of the catwalk, and the cheering subsided. Everyone must have expected Marcella to drop the redhead off there. Ahead of her was the press box, den of the exclusively male radio and newspaper corps. No woman had ever entered it without being summarily booted out. To general surprise, Marcella strode right in. As usual, she pulled it off. If anyone objected to her presence, no one said so. One admiring reporter proposed giving her a medal for bravery. But she didn't stay long. She had planned to watch the race with Pollard in the announcer's booth, where Clem McCarthy would call the race for national radio. But she was losing her nerve. The booth was on the roof of the track, up a 12-foot ladder. But it wasn't the climb that worried her. She was terrified that in the excitement of the race, she would scream into the caller's microphone. "I can't stand this," she said. Her hands were shaking. "It's not the race that's got me at the moment. Waiting for the start is going to be bad enough, but that microphone in there is worse." She turned and fled toward the catwalk. Gliding up ahead of her was Bing Crosby, decked out to see his Ligurati contest the race. The Seabiscuit and Ligurati camps had developed a lively, good-natured rivalry. Lynn Howard had placed a bank-breaking side bet with his father over which horse would finish ahead of the other. Bing snagged Marcella's arm. "Marcella," he cooed, "you come right in here and tell the people how far Seabiscuit is going to beat Ligurati." "That'll be easy," she replied, relaxing some and turning back to the reporters. "By about a quarter of a mile." Crosby led her back in, and she started up the ladder, the wind snapping her dress around her legs. Somehow, they hoisted Pollard up the ladder. Marcella sat down with him. They tried to distract each other from their trepidation. At the door of the jockey's room, Wolf shed his bodyguards. His mind was full of Stagehand. He made a mental note. Stagehand would carry the same colors as his nearly identical full brother, Scene Shifter, but to enable the race caller to discriminate between them, Stagehand's jockey was to wear a white cap, Scene Shifter's a red one. Wolf walked down to the paddock, where Clem McCarthy awaited him, microphone in hand for a live interview. "All I need is luck," Wolf told a rapt audience. "Seabiscuit will do the rest." Howard and Smith saw Seabiscuit and Wolf onto the track, then filed up into Howard's private box. They would say nothing to each other for the next 121 seconds. As Seabiscuit broke from the gate, he was immediately bashed inward by Count Atlas, a hopeless long shot emerging from the stall to his right. Seabiscuit was knocked nearly to the ground. As he staggered sideways, Count Atlas sped up in front of him, then abruptly cut left and slowed down, pushing back into him again. Seabiscuit stumbled badly, his head ducking, and Wolf was vaulted up onto his neck. For a terrible moment, Wolf clung to Seabiscuit's neck, a millimeter from falling off, then regained his balance. As he shinnied back in the saddle, Count Atlas leaned hard into Seabiscuit, buffeting his right side as the field bounded away from them. For a 1/16 of a mile, Count Atlas lay over on Seabiscuit's shoulder, his head and neck thrust to the left, preventing Seabiscuit from moving up. Wolf was enraged. Seabiscuit was struggling to push Count Atlas off of him. The front runners were disappearing in the distance, and his chances of winning were all but dashed. Swinging his whip high in the air, Wolf walloped it down as hard as he could on the buttocks of Count Atlas's jockey, Johnny Adams, then lifted it up and smacked it down again. Down on the rail, obscured by the pack of horses, he could not be seen by the stewards, the crowd. But Adams, who would ride back to the scales sporting angry welts, certainly felt it. He jerked Count Atlas's head to the right. Seabiscuit broke free. Finally back in his stirrups and straightened out, Wolf despaired over his position. Seabiscuit was in 12th place, 8 lengths behind the leaders. He was trapped in a pack of stragglers. Wolf had no option but to wait for a hole to break ahead of him. He sat still, his eyes pinned on the white cap bobbing ahead. On the backstretch, a slender jagged avenue through a cluster of horses opened before him. Wolf saw the white cap slipping out of reach and feared that this narrow path would be his only chance to break loose. With horses surging in and out, it was likely to vanish in an instant. To seize this opportunity, Wolf would have to reach for everything Seabiscuit had. Accelerating hard under high weight burns vast reserves of energy. Horses carrying the kind of weight Seabiscuit was packing cannot afford to lose momentum. If Wolf sent his mount to top speed, he knew he was going to have to keep him going until the end of the race. A general rule of racing is that virtually no horse can sustain his maximum speed for more than 3/8 of a mile. The Santa Anita handicap was a grueling 1.25 miles, and Seabiscuit still had more than 3/4 of a mile to go. Wolf faced a critical decision. If he took the lane opening ahead of him, Seabiscuit would almost certainly become exhausted in the home stretch, leaving himself vulnerable to closers. If he waited, Stagehand might be long gone by the time he launched his bid. Wolf made his choice. He pointed Seabiscuit's nose at the gap and asked him to go through. The response was explosive. Pent up from trailing the field, Seabiscuit spun through the gap like a bullet rifling down a barrel. Wolf balanced over his neck and steered him deftly through the pack on the hunt for the white cap. The quarters were so close and the speed so high that the jockey had to cut sharply in and out to avoid running up into the hind legs of horses. As Seabiscuit streaked past the 3/4 pole, several clockers saw what was happening and jammed their thumbs down on their stopwatches. In the announcer's booth, McCarthy caught sight of the horse. "Seabiscuit, he's coming through! He's cutting the others down like a whirlwind!" Wolf rolled up alongside the jockey in the white cap. He didn't have a chance to look at him. Seabiscuit was moving so fast that the jockey and his mount were behind him in an instant. Seabiscuit overtook a pack of horses and stretched out for a front-running aneroid, his last obstacle. The two ran side by side. They flew to the quarter pole, still sustaining a fearsome clip. The clockers banged their thumbs down on their stopwatches. The hands stared back at them. 44 1/5 seconds. In the middle stage of a grueling distance race, Seabiscuit had broken the half-mile world record by 2 seconds, the equivalent of more than 13 lengths. It may be the greatest display of raw speed ever seen in thoroughbred racing. Scorching around the far turn, Seabiscuit had the lead. The crowd was on its feet. Wolf had gambled everything, and it seemed to have worked. The field was in disarray behind him, dropping back in an undulating mass. From the far outside, Wolf felt something coming. He turned in the saddle and looked back. It was a lone horse, shaking loose from the pack and driving toward Seabiscuit as Rosemont had done a year before. Wolf studied the horse's head, then straightened out. He knew that face, a long aristocratic nose, mahogany deepening to black at the muzzle. But the silks on the rider didn't match. He had to be wrong. He swung his head back and looked again. There was no mistake. It was Stagehand. The realization shivered through Wolf. The caps of Stagehand and Scene Shifter had been switched. All the way around the track, the horse Wolf thought he had been chasing had in fact been behind him, stalking him. Wolf had spent Seabiscuit's rally much too early in pursuit of the wrong horse. Up in the grandstand, Stagehand's trainer, Earl Sandy, realized what was happening. "We've got the race!" he shouted. Nick Wall, aboard Stagehand, thought he had it too. He had sat behind Seabiscuit, watched him dash off on the backstretch, and thought that Wolf had lost his head. He was sure that Seabiscuit was finished. Wall was sitting on a fresh, perfectly conditioned horse, under a feather impost, just dropping down into his run. He thought, "I am going to gallop by him and win as I please." Streaking down the home stretch, Wolf was a crimson blur on Seabiscuit's back, lifting him, holding him together, begging him for more, dropping flat to lie under the wind. Wall wound Stagehand up to top speed, his eyes fixed on Wolf's back. He couldn't understand it. His horse was tearing over the track, but he was barely gaining. Gradually, he snipped away at the distance between them. They drew even. Seabiscuit disappeared, his compact body eclipsed from the crowd's view by Stagehand's long, dark form. It seemed that Stagehand would surely rush right by and that Seabiscuit would reappear in his wake. Up in the stands, Pollard thought it was over. But Seabiscuit did not appear. For as long as they lived, spectators would regard what they saw next as the most extraordinary feat they ever witnessed in sport. They recognized it all at once. Seabiscuit, under a tremendous load, having already run at world record speed for most of the race, accelerated. He surged forward with such power that it was as if, said one witness, he were breaking from the gate again. Stagehand could not shake him. The crowd was in a frenzy. McCarthy, one of the few commentators who had not mistaken Stagehand for Scene Shifter, was screaming himself hoarse. "It's Seabiscuit and Stagehand! They're coming away! It's all between them! They're almost here! Stagehand is running stronger, but Seabiscuit won't yield! How he tries!" It was too much for Pollard. He twisted in his chair and gasped for air, terrified, overjoyed. He was choking on it. His heart was thumping so hard in his chest that for a moment he wondered if it would fail, if he would die right there in the announcer's booth, the race still playing out beneath him. Marcella went white and shrieked. Someone behind her, remembering the microphone, clapped a hand over her mouth. Below them, Howard stood absolutely still. His binoculars had fallen from his hands. The rest of the field dropped into the distance. Stagehand and Seabiscuit drove side by side, blazing through a final quarter in 24 4/5 seconds, astounding for a distance race. Wall was hammering Stagehand at Seabiscuit, but Seabiscuit was hanging up against him and giving it right back, ferocious, head down, ears pinned. Wolf was strung flat over Seabiscuit's back, driving for all his worth. As the wire neared, the horses' heads bobbed out of time, so that the lead was traded every few feet. They hit the line together. Again, no one was sure who had won. There was the long wait, the murmuring crowd, the timer blinking a new track record, and again, the soft whir of the finish photos slipping down to the stewards. The photo was murky, indistinct. The stewards made their ruling. The winner was Stagehand. Atop the grandstand, Marcella and Red huddled together and wept. The jockey pulled himself up and smiled. He tried with every ounce, with every muscle in his body, he later said. I am proud of my horse. Howard and Smith sat cold and still in their box. By two noses, in two runnings of the race he and his wife most wanted to win, Howard had lost $182,150. And Seabiscuit had been denied the title of history's greatest money winner. Howard pushed out a faint laugh. Hell, he said. We can't win all the time. The press box wilted. Seabiscuit had delivered what many of them thought was the greatest performance in racing history, and had lost simply because of a fluke in the weight system and a foul from another horse. The best horse, wrote turf scribe Salvatore, was unjustly beaten. Stagehand cantered back to the winner's circle. That's the greatest racehorse in the world, Nick Wall would say of Seabiscuit. He had enough trouble to stop a locomotive. At equal weights, there's nothing that wears racing plates that's immortal to beat him. Seabiscuit returned to the grandstand, where Smith and the Howards awaited him. Wolf was rigid with rage. He slid down and dragged his kangaroo leather saddle off of Seabiscuit, so angry over the foul from Count Atlas that he could barely speak. It was the first time in his 10-year career that he had been beaten in a photo finish of a stakes race. Howard looked at Seabiscuit. The horse's head was high, and light played in his eyes. He didn't know he had lost. Howard felt confidence swell in himself once more. We'll try again, he said. Next time, we'll win it. Chapter 13 Hardball. A few minutes after Seabiscuit lost, the Howards reeled out of Santa Anita, changed into formal attire, raised their chins once again, and walked into the Santa Anita Turf Club ball, held in honor of Stagehand's victory. There was a buzz in the room. Hours before, beneath the swaying palms of Florida's Hialeah Park, War Admiral had logged his 10th consecutive victory, winning the Widener handicap with ease. The Triple Crown winner had become so unruly that before many of his races, the battered assistant starters gave up on loading him into the gate and instead let him walk up to the break on the far outside of the gate while the other horses started from a standstill inside it. But once underway, he was better than ever. In the Widener, he had delivered a smashing performance, and everyone was comparing it to Seabiscuit's extraordinary run in the Santa Anita handicap. The two horses were the talk of the ball and the nation. The next morning, magazines and newspapers all over the country would be running side-by-side photographs of War Admiral's victory and Seabiscuit's defeat. Scores of sports columns and publications of every stripe focused on the merits of the two horses. The prospect of a meeting between the two was becoming an international obsession. All evening, reporters circled around Howard, asking if he'd be willing to match his horse against Riddle's colt. Howard, as always, said yes. After the ball, the operators of California's new Hollywood Park approached him with a formal match race proposal. Howard told them that if they could get Riddle on board, Seabiscuit was in. The officials agreed to consult Riddle at his home in Pennsylvania. Howard waited to see what would happen. Again, nothing did. Howard's patience had run out. For a year, he had practically pleaded for a match on any terms, but Riddle remained uninterested. Riddle did not believe that Seabiscuit was in War Admiral's league, and may have felt that by agreeing to run against a Western horse in a match race, he would be demeaning his colt. Even if he had held a higher opinion of Seabiscuit, he had nothing to gain from a match race. War Admiral had already won the Horse of the Year title without having to meet Seabiscuit. Because of the championship voters' pronounced bias toward Eastern horses in general, and War Admiral in particular, Seabiscuit almost certainly could not dethrone the Horse of the Year without beating him on the track. War Admiral was sucking up a fortune in purse money and barely needed to extend himself against the horses he did run against. In many of his races, only two or three owners were willing to send their horses out to face him. Riddle had no reason to disrupt his colt's schedule to take on Seabiscuit and accept a risk, however small, that a fluke would cost his horse the championship. If Seabiscuit showed up for one of War Admiral's scheduled full-field races, that was fine, but Riddle could see no reason why he should agree to a match. Howard was in the opposite position. Like Riddle, he understood that Seabiscuit had to conquer War Admiral on the track to be deemed his superior in the championship voting and in history. With so much riding on the meeting, he and Smith did not want their horse to meet War Admiral in a full-field race, in which he would run the risk of a third horse interfering with him, as Count Atlas had done in the 100-grander. The risk of interference was not the same for each horse. War Admiral's early speed was so overpowering that he was nearly always able to blast out to a lone lead, on the rail and away from other horses, and the walk-up starts ensured that he broke by himself, unhindered by his opponents. In contrast, Seabiscuit broke with the rest of the field, and as a pace stalker, he had to make his run from out of the crowded pack. Howard needed a match race, and he was ready to force the issue. His target was a bespectacled former journalist named Herbert Bayard Swope, chairman of the New York Racing Commission, the governing body of War Admiral's home turf. If anyone could get the match arranged, Swope could. One afternoon in early March of 1938, Howard sat down with Swope and told him that he wanted Seabiscuit to meet War Admiral, and he wanted Swope to use his influence to arrange it. Swope suggested that he enter Seabiscuit in the Suburban Handicap at Belmont Park, in which War Admiral would meet a full field, and he said he would try to get the purse raised from $20,000 to $50,000. It was not the scenario that Howard wanted, but he sensed it was not yet time to push the issue. He told Swope to work on it, and if things moved forward, they could talk again. Swope agreed. In the aftermath of the Santa Anita Handicap, everyone at the track was buzzing about the foul Count Atlas had committed against Seabiscuit. Several reporters, remembering the foiled attempts to kidnap Wolf and tamper with Seabiscuit, speculated that the foul was the result of a race-fixing conspiracy. Santa Anita had made films of the race, but the stewards had not looked at them. A group of newspapermen petitioned the stewards to see the films. Expecting to see only Count Atlas fouling Seabiscuit, the newspapermen saw that and something more. They gave the films back with hearty encouragement that the stewards have a look. The stewards watched the race. The film showed it clearly. Wolf had lifted his whip up and repeatedly cracked Johnny Adams on the flanks. Wolf was called on the carpet. When asked if he had hit Adams, he said sure he had, explaining that Adams had been laying his horse over on Seabiscuit. Wolf was suspended for the rest of the meet. Adams was not penalized. Howard was furious. "If Wolf did not protect Seabiscuit," he seethed, "it was a cinch the stewards wouldn't. I noticed that while Wolf had been set down, Adams still rides. Hence I think that it was up to Wolf to protect his own mount. It was unfortunate that he had to strike Adams, but there was no recourse. I don't blame Wolf for not standing idly by and allowing another rider to ruin his chances in a $100,000 race. Guess we'll have to teach the biscuit to act up at the post, to kick and rear and plunge and otherwise misbehave himself," he said bitterly. "Then he'll be allowed to start outside the gate, where he can break free without risk of interference. That's War Admiral's act, and it seems to be an effective one. When they're out to get your horse, you're a lot better off having him away from the crowd, I'm beginning to think." His words fell upon deaf ears. Howard had to find a new jockey, and right away. He had accepted an invitation to run Seabiscuit in Tijuana during Wolf's suspension. In 1934, when Mexico banned gambling, the lively Tijuana that Wolf and Pollard had known faded. The recent re-legalization of racing had done little to bring back the town's glory days. Agua Caliente Racetrack, built for $3 million in 1929 but sold for just $140,000 in 1936, remained a shadow of its former self. Then Caliente official Gene Normile came up with the idea of renewing the track's namesake championship race and inviting Seabiscuit down for it. There was no surer sell in all of sports. Howard could hardly refuse. After the 100-grander, Santa Anita's racing secretary had assigned Seabiscuit £135 for the San Juan Capistrano his next scheduled race. Howard never considered running his horse under such an impost, and Normile made the choice easier. Because Mexican racing officials were not bound by the mandate that every horse carry at least 100 pounds, they could give Seabiscuit 130 while assigning other horses fewer than 100 if they needed to. Howard accepted. Although still angry over Wolf's suspension, Howard didn't want to court more trouble with California racing officials by hiring Wolf for the Mexican race. California was still Seabiscuit's home base. With Smith's approval, Howard hired Speck Richardson to ride. Normile had pulled off a coup in getting Seabiscuit to come down for the Agua Caliente handicap, but now he faced another quandary. No one was willing to run against Howard's horse. Normile sweetened the pot for second through fifth places and offered extraordinary breaks in the weights, giving them between 22 and 32 fewer pounds than Seabiscuit. That did the trick. Seven other horses were entered to try for second place. Team Seabiscuit arrived in high style. Howard motored down in the first of eight Buick limousine coaches, packed with 30 of his closest friends. Seabiscuit rolled in, the fans massing by the sides of his van like snowdrifts. The van door slid open. The horse appeared. The flashbulbs crackled, and the crowd pushed forward. Accompanied by two Pinkerton guards, Seabiscuit swept down the ramp and into the mob. He struck a handsome pose and held it. He had been posed so often that he seemed to know what was wanted of him when the press corps buzzed around, prompting the reporters to dub him Movie Star. As always, he dutifully raised his head, pricked his ears, fanned his tail, and stood square when he saw the cameras raised. When he heard the shutters click, he relaxed. The track photographer asked for a profile shot, and Seabiscuit was turned for it. Each time the man prepared to snap the shot, the horse cocked his head and looked at the camera. The photographer tried hiding in the bushes while his assistant distracted the horse, but again, Seabiscuit swung his head around to stare at him. After 8 minutes, Smith pulled out a carrot and thrust it in the hand of the assistant. "Here," he said. "He loves these. Hold it just out of reach and let your man take the picture." It worked. Pollard was finally well enough to travel and return to the town in which he had once reigned supreme. He found it shriveled and spent. The great racetrack was now a hollow, rattling place. Most of the bars and shops that had sprung up around it had shuttered their doors. The pulsing avenues down which Wolf had steered his purring Studebakers and cords were wind-whipped and quiet. Even the Molino Rojo girls were gone. The home of glorious, smoke-blowing women had been born again, transformed into, of all things, a schoolhouse. It would later become a church. One of the few healthy businesses in town was the sad trade in divorces, handled quickly and easily in cold offices that had once been noisy saloons. But for one afternoon in the spring of 1938, Seabiscuit resurrected the old Tijuana and Agua Caliente. Long before Seabiscuit Day, the Americans began arriving. Hotels filled up with Seabiscuit fans hailing from all over the United States. Officials, recognizing that they were playing host to the most adored visitor ever to cross city limits, rushed to prepare. The railroad scheduled special trains to carry the masses of humanity southward. Crews worked to widen all roads leading in from California. The track installed additional mutual windows, constructed about a dozen bookmaking facilities in the infield, opened up all vacant areas of the clubhouse, and hired an army of extra personnel. Though the parking lot could hold 15,000 automobiles, officials knew that that wouldn't be nearly enough. They began clearing out space for additional parking. Their efforts didn't make much difference. Just after dawn on race day, March 27th, the first headlights blinked over the border crossing. By noon, the road to hell was snarled with Seabiscuit fans. Border police were swamped, trying in vain to ease the gridlock by dividing traffic into four lanes. Within a few hours, cars had backed up from the track entrance all the way to the border. At the track, the additional parking was used up early in the day, and spectators began leaving their cars on the shoulders of the road and hiking in. When the shoulders filled up, they fanned out into the city golf club, then right onto residential lawns. Long before the first race, The track was filled well beyond capacity with the largest attendance in its history. The congregation at the paddock alone was greater than the track's total attendance the day before. The mob devoured all the food in the clubhouse. They set an all-time wagering record and bet Seabiscuit down to the lowest odds ever seen at Caliente. The grandstand was soon so crammed that just before the race, masses of suffocating fans spilled over the fence and onto the racetrack. Unable to wedge them back into the grandstand, officials herded them into the infield. Police were stationed along the rails to prevent fans from seeping back onto the track in front of the horses. Photographers circled the course, their cameras ready. The race was over the instant it began. Seabiscuit bounded out of the gate in front and galloped away from his competition. Bored, he began swinging his head around. According to Richardson, each time the horse passed a photographer, he would prick up his ears and hoist his tail until the rider reminded him of what he was there for. To enthusiastic applause, Seabiscuit cantered home. Richardson had a miserable time trying to pull him to a stop and turn him back toward the winner's circle, where Howard, Smith, and Bing Crosby awaited him. Someone swore that as Bing handed the trophy to Howard, Tom Smith smiled. It was only a rumor. The crowd swarmed onto the roads once again, pausing to clean out Caesar's restaurant of every morsel of food well before the dinner hour. Cars were still stacked up at the border long into the night. It took 2 days for the town to clean up. On March 29, 1938, 2 days after the Caliente triumph, the Seabiscuit train drew into Tanforan. Several hundred fans were waiting. Howard traveled over to Bay Meadows. There, he received a wire from Swope, who had a pleasant surprise. He had been true to his word. He had sold Belmont Chief Joseph Widener on a full-field meeting between Seabiscuit and War Admiral in the Suburban Handicap on Memorial Day, May 30th, with an augmented purse of $50,000. Now that the issue was in the works and Belmont was moving forward, Howard sensed that it was time to play hardball. He picked up the phone and called Swope. After agitating for so long for the race, he said no to Swope's proposal. He made a string of demands. He wanted a one-on-one race. He wanted it run at Belmont, over a mile and a quarter, but not on Memorial Day, which would conflict with Seabiscuit's schedule. He suggested sometime between September 15th and October 1st. He wanted the horses to carry equal weights, proposing 126 pounds, but leaving himself open to any weight Riddle wanted, so long as both horses carried the same. And he wanted a much, much bigger purse. When Swope heard Howard's figure, he must have blanched. $100,000. Howard wasn't kidding. If Swope failed to get that much, Howard said, he could take Seabiscuit to a certain western track, which had already offered such a sum. Howard, who had long felt victimized by eastern disdain for western racing, now tried to exploit it. Belmont Park, the country's leading racetrack, he said, should be willing to at least meet that figure. It was an audacious play. He was asking for a king's ransom, and he was bluffing. Hollywood Park had indeed mentioned $100,000, but Howard knew that Samuel Riddle would never take his horse west to race. He was counting on Swope's ignorance of that fact. Howard knew he had to find a way to give Riddle a strong interest in running, so he had done his homework. He approached Riddle as he approached the marketplace, tailoring the proposal to the owner's desires. Horses have strong preferences for particular courses, and Belmont was War Admiral's home track, the site of his greatest performance. A mile and a quarter was War Admiral's optimal distance. Howard had learned that Riddle shared his ambition to break Sunbow's all-time earnings record by season's end. The $100,000 purse would be highly appealing. And he knew that Riddle was deeply concerned about the weight his horse was asked to carry. Before the Widener handicap, War Admiral had never carried more than 128 pounds. Riddle set a limit of 130. Ranted at the Hialeah racing secretary when the horse received just that, then balked when another track secretary assigned the horse 132 pounds for a later race. The weight issue was putting War Admiral's schedule in doubt, and Howard's offer to run under any weight provided an alternative. Riddle's image, never wonderful, also stood to benefit. With this proposal, he would be able to accept every one of Howard's conditions, casting himself as the good guy who was sportingly making concessions to his demanding opponent, even though it was he who was getting the bargain. Finally, Howard's proposal gave Riddle a built-in excuse. If War Admiral lost, Riddle could always say that Howard had dictated the terms of the race. It was an offer that was very hard to refuse. It also must have been very hard to make. In his drive to bring Riddle to the table, Howard was gambling with his own horse's chances. Howard much preferred that the race be held in the West. If it were held at Belmont, Seabiscuit would have to endure a 5-day, 3,200-mile train trip to get there. Belmont posed another problem. Seabiscuit had run there only once, under Fitzsimmons' care, and he had been humiliated. Smith warned Howard that Belmont's mile-and-a-half circumference was so large that the race would be run around just one turn, instead of the two turns necessary to complete a mile-and-one-quarter at every other track in America. One of Seabiscuit's major weapons was his supremacy at running turns. Racing around just one turn at Belmont would deprive him of one of his strengths. There was a strong possibility that if Howard secured the match race on these terms, his horse would be too compromised to win. It was a daring play, but Howard felt it was his only chance. Swope must have swallowed hard. Howard had masterminded a situation that made refusal costly. Led to believe that Howard had very different conditions in mind, Swope had already sent Belmont officials scurrying to arrange a meeting between the two horses, and if the deal fell through now, his reputation within the organization might be tarnished. The reaction of the public was another problem. News of the race negotiations had broken the day before. Howard had undoubtedly leaked it to the press, and the response was nationwide jubilation. Telegrams applauding the proposal were flooding the Racing Commission offices. The papers were full of stories and cartoons about the prospect of the match. The phone in Swope's office never stopped ringing. Belmont was already talking with CBS Radio, which was offering to broadcast the race live worldwide, predicting that 20 million sets would be tuned to it. If the deal died now, there might be a public backlash against Belmont. Finally, Howard had raised the mortifying possibility that the most spectacular draws in racing would stage their epic meeting in the West, costing Belmont the opportunity to host what promised to be one of the greatest and most heavily attended sporting events ever held. Swope was trapped. He returned with a complete proposal that met Howard's demands to the letter. He even agreed to the $100,000 purse, winner take all. Swope rushed to complete the deal. He contacted Riddle, who did not immediately get back to him. With Belmont head Joseph Widener committed to the idea, the only remaining hurdle before the track could make an official offer was C.V. Whitney, a powerful member of the Westchester Racing Association's board of directors, the governing body for Belmont. The formal vote on the proposal would be made at the April 12th board meeting, but as the majority of voters could be expected to follow Whitney's lead, his opinion was everything. Swaying him was a tall order. A staunch opponent of match races and big purses, he was likely to come out against the plan. On April 6th, Widener sent the proposal by wireless to Whitney, who was on his boat fishing off the shores of Bermuda. Widener could not reach him. The delay proved critical. All over the United States, track managers realized that Belmont had beaten them to the punch. They hustled to put together match proposals, and Howard and Riddle were suddenly bombarded with offers. On the same day that Widener was attempting to contact Whitney to finalize a race plan, Chicago's Arlington Park made a formal proposal to Howard and Riddle for a $100,000 match race in July, months before the Belmont race date. Howard, playing them against Belmont, said he was open to any proposals. All eyes turned to Riddle. He was, at long last, willing to negotiate. On April 6th, he shipped War Admiral to Belmont. The next day, he wired Swope to tell him he was coming to town the following morning. But he, too, seemed to be toying with Belmont. To Swope's distress, Riddle sent a similar telegram to an Arlington official, who rushed to New York to meet with him the same day. Judging from his comments to his associates, his remarks about Chicago's infernal July weather, and his general aversion to racing in the West, Riddle was almost certainly not considering the Arlington offer, but he was not above making Swope sweat it out.
"Why not have two races? One at Arlington, the other at Belmont," he said. "That should please everyone."
Swope was appalled. If both races were agreed upon, Belmont's race would be of far less interest, especially if the first event proved decisive. Complaining that the Chicago people were muscling in on his match race, Swope went into overdrive. He sent a flurry of wires to Howard, extolling the superb racing strip, mild fall weather, and general beauty of New York. Howard telephoned him back, reminding him that it was $100,000 or nothing. Riddle sat down with Swope. As Howard had foreseen, he loved the conditions. His only suggestion was that the race be held sooner than September, as the form of either horse might tail off before then. Swope took his request under consideration. Riddle told the Arlington officials to hold their offer open. The critical date, April 12th, neared. Everyone waited for Whitney. En route from Bermuda, he was the focus of intense pressure. The press worked on him, talking of how much revenue New York would lose if Whitney turned it down, and inviting the fans, who at this point were in agonies of anticipation, to lay the blame squarely on his shoulders if the race fell through. On the morning before the meeting, Howard cranked up the pressure.
"You can tell them Seabiscuit will meet War Admiral anywhere, weight for age, track fast, from a quarter mile to a couple of miles," he said. "I have been willing for a long time. Personally, I want to know which is the best horse. And there are a million racing patrons who would like to know the answer to the same question."
"When these two meet," he continued, "whether it be at Belmont Park, Bay Meadows, Tanfren, or Pumpkin Corners, they can bet me until the bell rings." While the world awaited Whitney, an event at Tanfren introduced a new wrinkle in the match plans. Only 2 months after being rescued, as they lay side by side on the track at Santa Anita, Red Pollard and Fair Nitus emerged from the dim interiors of the Howard barn and made their first steps back out on the racetrack. The mare, brought back from temporary paralysis by Smith's exhaustive labors, moved stiffly and hesitantly through an easy canter. She was finally out of danger. Pollard, too, was tentative. Though he presented himself as fully healed, he was barely using his left arm, and his ribs were still bound in tape. Smith let him make his own choices and slipped him up on Seabiscuit's back for a few light gallops. The jockey held up well. Howard contacted his personal physicians, who scheduled Pollard for X-rays on April 13th. On April 12th, Whitney finally materialized at the board meeting. Out in California, Howard waited for news. After a long interval, he was handed a telegram from Whitney. The board had voted unanimously in favor of the proposal. The race would be one-on-one, though not officially a match race. By antiquated racing rules, a match had to be a purseless race. There was one change. Complying with Riddle's wishes, they would schedule the race for Memorial Day, May 30th, not September. Would Howard accept? Howard telephoned him back just as Riddle walked into Whitney's office. The three men settled in to an impromptu meeting. Howard agreed to the new date, but inserted a new condition. Pollard must ride. If he was not able to, the race was off. They broke without final agreement. Over the telephone late that night, Riddle and Swope talked it out. Riddle had a habit of raising his voice to a blasting volume when on the phone. He was booming so loudly that a man in the room with Swope said he would have had to leap out the window to avoid hearing every word. In the end, Riddle barked his assent.
"You know very well," he bellowed at Swope. "My horse will beat the stuffing out of him."
After having demanded and received the concession that the race be held in the spring, Riddle grumbled that his horse would really do better against an older horse in the fall. Nevertheless, he said, he was willing to go ahead with a spring race. The following day, Pollard stripped for his X-rays. Howard's physicians went over them. The fractures had healed. With a lot of conditioning, the jockey might be able to ride in May. Howard picked up the telephone at his Burlingame home and gave Swope his acceptance. The Arlington officials bowed out gracefully. The news rippled over the world. The race, anticipated to be the greatest in the sport's history, was on. Before the meeting, there was another race to be run. Bay Meadows had arranged to hold a charity day for crippled children on the April 16th date of its namesake handicap, and Howard couldn't say no. After Seabiscuit's extraordinarily easy win in Tijuana, the Bay Meadows racing secretary had proposed assigning him 136 pounds, but Howard had intercepted him and charmed 3 pounds off of his horse's impost. Still, 133 pounds was the highest weight any horse had ever lugged in modern California racing, and every other horse in the field would be carrying at least 20 fewer pounds. The only one who was happy about it was Wolf. Despondent over Seabiscuit's loss in the Santa Anita handicap, and seizing the opportunity to eat as his diabetes dictated while his suspension was in effect, he had gorged himself on steaks and ballooned up to 128 pounds. With tack, he only just made the weight. The entire earth seemed to wedge itself into Bay Meadows to see Seabiscuit run. The track, flooded with by far the largest crowd ever to attend a horse race in San Francisco, was overwhelmed. Officials shunted thousands into the infield, but still found the track so packed that people could barely move. The grandstand became an undulating, endless sea of earth-toned fedoras and ladies' spring hats. Fans lay on, stood over, and clung to every support structure, making the track appear as if it were constructed entirely of spectators. They ran out of programs before the third race. The supply of hot dog buns, a key barometer of fan enthusiasm, was completely exhausted by early afternoon. Attendants served the dogs up on rye bread, and when that ran out, hungry fans had to hold their dogs in old newspapers and then discarded mutual tickets. Though officials lengthened the time between races considerably, the wagering lines were so long that many bettors never caught a glimpse of a paramutual window. "One unfortunate citizen," wrote a reporter, "got in line to buy a win ticket on Patty Cake in the sixth, and was considerably bewildered to find himself coming out of the melee at the end of the seventh with a hot dog." The gridlock in the parking lot was so intractable that, even though the races ended at 6:30 p.m., it would be well into Sunday morning before everyone got out of the track. It was all worth it. Seabiscuit buried the field, demolishing the track record by 1 2/5 seconds. The fans went wild, taking up a raucous cheer. "Bring on War Admiral! Bring on War Admiral!" For Wolf, the win was bittersweet. It was, he believed, the last time he would ever sit astride this little horse. He slid from the saddle, pulled the wreath of flowers from around Seabiscuit's neck, and wrapped it around his own shoulders. The Howard stood on each side of him, laughing with the crowd. Wolf didn't smile. He paused a moment, the camera flashes flickering off his cheeks. Pollard was looking down on him from the press box. Wolf consigned the horse back to him. He walked back to the jockey's room, slipped out of the Howard silks, and hung them up. A few days after the Bay Meadows handicap, Seabiscuit's train clattered to a stop at the Tanforan siding for the long trek east. Team Seabiscuit was slated to stop off in Maryland to fulfill a promise to Alfred Vanderbilt to run in Pimlico's Dixie Handicap, then go on to meet War Admiral in New York. Grooms tramped on and off the train, loading a full car to the roof with rice straw bedding, oats, and Timothy hay. A multitude stood by to see Seabiscuit off. Howard pulled up in a long Buick packed with admirers. He stepped out with a big cake in hand and gave it to the grooms, who quickly devoured it, then said goodbye to his horse. He would follow him east later. Fans brought heaps of flowers, and a woman stepped forward and braided ribbons into Seabiscuit's mane while he posed for the inevitable photographers. The ceremony over, Seabiscuit clopped into his rail car, stacked chest deep in straw. Pumpkin followed. Smith climbed in with him and set up his customary cot beside Seabiscuit. The train pushed off. A continent away, War Admiral stood in his stall at Belmont, waiting. As the train lurched into motion, Seabiscuit was suddenly agitated.
He began circling around and around the car in distress. Unable to stop him, Smith dug up a copy of Captain Billy's Whiz-Bang magazine and began reading aloud. Seabiscuit listened. The circling stopped. As Smith read on, the horse sank down into the bedding and slept. Smith drew up a stool and sat by him. The trainer had a dark feeling. Since the Bay Meadows handicap, he'd had a nagging sense that the horse was not quite right. Though Seabiscuit had won the race easily, running the final quarter in a blazing 24 seconds flat and obliterating the track record by 1 2/5 seconds, he had dragged early in the race. Wolf had needed to hustle him to keep up with the frontrunners. Howard had shrugged off the slow early fractions, attributing them to the difficulty of accelerating under 133 pounds. But Smith was uneasy. It wasn't just that the horse seemed a hair off form. The trainer was worried about match race strategy. From his years holding Irwin's horses for relay races and matches, Smith knew something about one-on-one races. If one horse could steal a commanding early lead, he almost always won. Clearly, superior braking speed in a match race was almost always a trump card. Against ordinary horses, Seabiscuit had enough early speed, but War Admiral was no ordinary horse. He was one of the fastest braking horses racing had ever seen. Conventional racing wisdom holds that a horse's natural running style cannot be altered. But to have any chance against War Admiral, Smith knew he was going to have to make the habitually pace-stalking Seabiscuit, who had to fight the inertia of a much blockier, heavier body, into a rocket-fast breaker. As the train snaked eastward, Smith abruptly made a change in plans. He didn't want Seabiscuit to run in the Dixie handicap. He needed time to prepare for the race and feel out this sense of wrongness in the horse. Howard was reluctant to break his promise to Vanderbilt, but he was not about to overrule Smith when the trainer was so certain. The itinerary was changed. Seabiscuit was going straight to Belmont to prepare for War Admiral. They could make it up to Vanderbilt later. Rocking on his stool as the train wound over the mountains, Smith began formulating a training plan. "We've got to tear off that guy's epaulets," he said aloud. "Pull the ostrich feather out of his hat and break his sword in two early, or we'll never even get close enough to the Admiral to give him the sailor's farewell." Almost no one thought he could do it. Chapter 14 The Wise Wee Boys. Seabiscuit slept for most of the trip to Belmont, rising only when reporters tramped aboard the train at the stops between San Francisco and New York. The newsmen had learned how to buy access to their source. Several of them came on board laden with carrots, which Seabiscuit fished from their pockets. Whenever food showed, Smith noted, he was quick to get up. When the human buffet cleared out of the train, down Seabiscuit would go again. On April 26th, the horse completed his 24,265th mile of career rail travel. He was stretched out on his side in the straw when the Overland Limited drew up in New York. The big rail car door slid open, and Seabiscuit got up, shook off the straw, and poked his head out. 200 people surged forward. Smith appeared and glared back at them from under the gray fedora. He led Seabiscuit down the ramp and stood for a moment, frowning as the horse blinked in the sun and yawned. Flashbulbs blinked, and movie cameras whirred as Seabiscuit stood there, posing. Several score of newsmen were scattered among the fans, eyeing the horse critically. Long before Seabiscuit arrived, the polls on the race had begun. Virtually every reporter and horseman in the East thought that War Admiral would prove to be Seabiscuit's master. The New York bookies were having a tough time trying to find anyone willing to put a few bucks on Seabiscuit. 95% of the wagers were on War Admiral. Down in Louisville to cover the Kentucky Derby, Oscar Otis found that he was about the only journalist who thought Seabiscuit could win. Other reporters thought he was addled. "It's going to be a pretty good horse race," wrote the New York World Telegram, "until Seabiscuit flattens out like a rug at the 16th pole." Seabiscuit, wrote another reporter, was a hero in California and a pretty fair sort of horse in the Midwest. In the East, however, he was just a bum.
Smith led Seabiscuit down the gallery.